Vodafone is buying 140 phones for use stores in a move that'll save almost 900 jobs. But administrators for the mobile retailer say another 628 head office and telesales staff have been made redundant. That's the latest. I'm Joe Davies.
There's a method to their madness. There's really not much method to yours, because you're operating from a place of ignorance. And until you change that, you're going to be bumbling around, bumping into each other, saying and doing the wrong things, not understanding the nature of your enemy. And if you don't understand the nature of your enemy and the weapons they use, you cannot fight that enemy. You can't fight the battle. You shouldn't even be on the battlefield.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. One expert believes the downed Ukrainian airliner was shot down by an air-to-air attack. Why wasn't that in the official report? So what have we learned from the interim report released into the Ukrainian-Malaysian airliner crash? Well, it wasn't a crash, was it? It was downed. We hear from former Lufthansa pilot Peter Hysenko. And 70 years ago this week, the biggest airborne operation ever took place. It was the liberation of Holland, Operation Market Garden, towards the end of the Second World War in September 1944. The operation's failure allowed Hitler an extra 6 months to bury his treasure. That was the looted wealth of the whole of Europe, apart from Switzerland, of course, before the end of the war. Much of it maybe ended up in Switzerland. So was Market Garden sabotaged by Nazi spies and Brits who wanted a share of the Nazi loot? And I personally can't let a September the 11th slip by without some comment, as it did a week ago or so when I was away. This was the 13th anniversary of the attack that supposedly changed the world. An attack that has still, to this day, not been properly investigated. We hear tonight from the former US Naval Intelligence Officer turned US radio talk show host who predicted the 9/11 attacks 2 whole months before they happened. Plus, Martin will take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, won't you, Mr. Martin Summers? First of all, Boko Haram. We've been talking about this. You've been talking about it with Billy. You did a fantastic job while I was away for the last couple of weeks. Thank you, Billy. But what's the latest you've got on this particular story? The worrying thing is that Boko Haram is not some kind of autonomous Muslim organisation. It's that there's all sorts of Western help and possibly Nigerian government help as well.
Yeah, well, the story I was given by my source, Tony, was that Dr. Stephen Davis, who is an Australian and the Archbishop of Canterbury's representative in Nigeria, he has now come out. But when we first ran the story 3 weeks ago, it was not in the public domain that he was going to speak out, saying that various politicians in Nigeria, northern politicians of the All Progressive Congress, were in fact channeling money from Al-Qaeda to Boko Haram as part of a strategy to undermine the current government of Nigeria, of Goodluck Jonathan. So we ran that story, and then it did come out in the Nigerian media the following week that he was indeed speaking out. And if people want to check up this, they can check up Dr. Stephen Davis, and you will see that these are the kind of allegations he's been making. What I was told yesterday, and this is again in the public domain, is that MEP Franz Obermeier of the Freedom Party in Austria has given out a press release this week in which he suggests that EU money, which has been channeled through the All Progressive Congress politicians, has been channeled to Boko Haram. And therefore, the shock horror aspect of this story is that EU money and Al-Qaeda money is being channeled to Boko Haram by what are supposedly legitimate politicians of the All Progressive Congress. But of course, the real question is, who is Al-Qaeda and who funds it? We know what's been going on in Syria, for example, that the Al-Qaeda groups Al-Nusra and ISIS have been funded by people in Qatar and in Saudi Arabia, and the training was carried out by US and British special forces in Jordan and Turkey. And I'd just like to remind people about the so-called underpants bomber, who was from northern Nigeria.
Well, just before you do, I'd just like to give a quote from the Nigerian Guardian, which is just literally a story that's come out today about this. Stephen Davis, the article says, and sponsors of the sponsors of Boko Haram. Now, according to news reports, Dr. Davis mentioned, as you said, a senior official at the Central Bank of Nigeria, former Borno State Governor Ali Modu Sharif, mm-hmm. and the immediate past Chief of the Army Staff, Lieutenant General Azubiki Onibeo. I think I pronounced that right, as three of the culprits in the nefarious and treasonous business. Al-Haji Sharif called a press conference in Abuja to deny Davis's accusations and profess his innocence, and repudiating the label of terrorism sponsorship. So there's obviously a big contest going on over in Nigeria about this. But anyway, underpants bomber.
Yeah, well, as I say, it's people need to be reminded about him. He was from northern Nigeria. He was actually from a very wealthy family, Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalab. But of course, if people go to Kurt Haskell's blog, Kurt Haskell and Laurie Haskell were passengers on the plane. Kurt is actually a senior lawyer in the US, and they both submitted affidavits at the trial of Abdul Muttalab, saying that he'd been taken onto the plane without any kind of security being any kind of security check at all, and that he didn't even have a passport, and that the security in Schiphol Airport where he went onto the plane is controlled by an Israeli-based company called ICTS, which also controls various airports around the world, including all three airports where people supposedly got on planes on 9/11. Since you've mentioned 9/11. Now, the wider point I would make is this. There is absolutely overwhelming evidence that Western intelligence services, including MI6, have been working very closely with extremist Muslim groups in Libya, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, in Syria, with groups connected to ISIS, who are now being told as public enemy number one. They've all been trained by British special forces in recent years. British people will know exactly what I'm talking about, who have been involved. And the fact is that what's going on is these groups are being set up and run by Western intelligence. And in Nigeria, the goal is to get Western intervention in Nigeria to ensure that Nigeria doesn't become a threat to Western interests in Africa, for example, by doing any deals that we wouldn't like with the Chinese. And they want to break up big countries like Nigeria, which have the potential to bargain on a solid basis with Western multinationals. They want lots and lots of small countries where the politics is run by big powers who are pulling the strings from outside. But the evidence is overwhelming. And don't forget that the underpants bomber is definitely, that we've got eyewitness accounts saying that he was taken onto the plane without having any security checks at all. And I'm afraid that the relationship between Western intelligence services and these far Islamic groups is decades old, and it's still ongoing. So there's all sorts of evidence suggesting that your tax dollars, dear readers and listeners, have been used to fund ISIS in Syria, and your tax dollars will also be used to bomb them back into the Stone Age.
Well, we've also got whilst I was away, we had the quite fascinating announcement of the interim report into the downing of the MH17 Malaysian airliner. Martin, where's that at the moment, do you think?
Well, I mean, the first point to make about that is normal procedure for assessing what's happened with an airline crash simply hasn't been followed in this case. Simply hasn't been followed. The rebels handed over the black boxes to the Russian authorities, who handed them to the Malaysian authorities, who then handed them to the British authorities. Goodness knows why. The British have no jurisdiction in this. And we should have heard by now what was on these black boxes. We should also have heard the air traffic control tapes.
Well, what they've said about the air traffic control is that the last command that anyone has actually got a copy of was a sort of routine, something to do with deviating or changing course or something, and that actually there's no recording of the pilot, the co-pilot, the cabin crew or whatever, what they were saying as the aircraft was under attack. because I imagine because it was such a quick attack, there was no chance for them to say anything.
Well, why in that case did the secret police in Kiev come to the airport and seize the tapes?
But isn't that what police would do in that sort of situation? Normally, the police would come and get the evidence.
Well, yes, but don't forget in the case of the other Malaysian airline that went down, we have got all of the air traffic control chat with the people on the flight deck, and all of this stuff should have come out. What's effectively happened is that Western public opinion has been bamboozled into believing that the Russians shot it down, although the evidence is piling up in actual fact that it was shot down by two fighters from Kiev. We've got eyewitness statements saying that, recorded by BBC journalists who were on the ground, Russian journalists, which were then reported and then suppressed. Now, the point is that because of the shooting down of the plane, a trade war with Russia was initiated, which is the goal of those who shot the plane down. They want a trade war with Russia because they don't want Germany and Russia to have a developed economic relationship. They want the Germans to sign up to this TTIP. Now, in other words, I would suggest to any Dutch people listening, it looks as if NATO intelligence services, working with the Kiev regime, shot down the plane in order to start a trade war with Russia. So all the relatives of those who died had better start thinking about who's really responsible for this. It's people in NATO. And I suggest that the Dutch government should get to the bottom of this or resign immediately, as they did over Srebrenica.
Well, the interim report's been released now into the downing of MH17. And one of the people who's immediately spoke out criticising it is a former Lufthansa pilot, Peter Hysenko. So he was appeared on the Russia Today's Anissa Now show. And this is what he had to say.
This report tells us nothing really new. As a matter of fact, I've never seen a comparable flimsy report like this about an aircraft accident. Interesting is the wording of a penetration of a large number of high-energy objects from outside the aircraft. So this is very diplomatic speech. In normal language, a high-energy object is described as a rifle bullet or something like that. I saw the news tonight on the German television, and they told the audience that it is most likely that a ground-to-air missile hit that aircraft, according to this report. But this report does not go conform with this side of view, because it only talks of a large number of high-energy objects, and large high-energy objects are normally bullets or something like that. And a book missile doesn't spread bullets. Well, this plane was shut down by an air-to-air attack. I'm quite sure about that. And there are round holes in this cockpit part. And these round holes do not go conform with any parts emitted by a book missile.
Yes, and the other thing that he didn't mention there is, if you look at the photographs, some of the bullets came in from one direction and some came from the other direction. So that's definitely couldn't possibly be a Buk missile. If a Buk missile had exploded nearby, maybe high energy particles might have hit the plane, but they'd have all come from the same direction.
Is it not possible
the bullet holes come from both directions?
Is it not possible you could have a missile warhead that would spray like little, not necessarily bullets, but almost like a gunshot pellet?
Yes, but at the same time, they wouldn't be coming from two different directions at once, because the explosion would have one source for the explosion. Don't forget, we've also got eyewitnesses on the ground, as interviewed by BBC Russia, who said, "We saw that plane shot down by planes." And the US, Russian General Staff gave a press conference where they showed their satellite photographs showing that there were planes shadowing MH17.
Well, there was also some eyewitnesses who said that they saw the aircraft make a left-hand turn, appearing to take evasive action, so you'd have thought that there would be some kind of transcript from the cockpit.
Well, indeed. And that's why we've not heard it. Now, what's happened is most ordinary people in the West have now been bamboozled into believing that the Russians shot it down, although they had no motive for so doing. Although there was very definitely a motive for Kiev to shoot it down in order to get more support from NATO for its war on Novorossiya in the east of Ukraine. But I don't suppose that Kiev will have done this on their own. Andrei Paribi, who was probably the instigator of the massacre in Odessa and the shootings in the Maidan Square at the beginning of the crisis, he resigned very quickly after this, possibly because he was responsible for bringing the plane down, and other people in the Kiev regime were not happy about that. But the fact of the matter is that evidence is piling up, and as Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has said, this, you know, we're the only people who seem to be interested in getting to the bottom of this. Everybody else has just made up their minds. Now, I put it to you that NATO intelligence services, given that they bomb Boulogne railway station, given that they've done all sorts of things over the years, are quite capable of working with far-right groups in Kiev to shoot down an airliner, kill lots of innocent people in order to start a war with Russia. And don't forget that we were talking earlier about the underpants bomber. It was taken onto the plane without any security check by ICTS, which is an Israeli-based company, and so on. So in other words, people have got to get their heads around the idea that the Western powers are quite capable of killing innocent people in order to achieve geopolitical objectives. It should be obvious to people by now, but I'm afraid people just want to hide their heads in the sand about it.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, Reuters are reporting today that an Ebola lockdown is bringing Sierra Leone's capital to a halt. Streets in the capital of Sierra Leone are deserted today as the West African state began a contested three-day lockdown in a bid to halt the worst Ebola outbreak on record. President Ernest Bai Koroma urged people to heed the emergency measures, and only vehicles driven by police and health workers took to the normally bustling roads of Freetown. Radio stations played Ebola awareness jingles on repeat and encouraged residents to stay indoors. Martin, this is getting pretty scary, isn't it?
It is, and we could argue about what caused Ebola and why is it there.
Number of infections. Ebola has, according to Reuters, infected some 5,350 people in West Africa this year, mainly in Sierra Leone, Guinea and Liberia, killing 2,600 of them.
Well, yes, and there are some that suggest that this is also part of a destabilisation strategy in relation to Africa, and that it's a deliberately created virus.
Okay, now, how can something like this possibly be deliberate? I mean, surely, you know, nobody's going around creating these viruses and just sort of spreading them out in the public.
Well, I'm not saying they are. But on the other hand, the idea that they might is very definitely there. The anthrax attacks, for example, after 9/11, the evidence for it, because the anthrax is actually traceable, it traces back to Fort Detrick in Maryland.
And the UN.
A US military facility. That's where that anthrax came from.
And the UN.
And they deliberately infected people and killed six people with that anthrax in order to create a geopolitical crisis and for their own purposes. Now, if they're prepared to kill six people with that, how many more people are prepared to kill with something else?
Well, I think even more than that died in Haiti. The UN brought cholera to Haiti. The UN actually refused to answer that, but it was proved beyond any shadow of a doubt that the origin of the cholera in Haiti was actually the UN mission to Haiti.
Which may have been an accident or may not. Don't forget that what is required in the developing countries is the creation of chaos so that it allows the Western powers and their multinational allies to clean up and keeps out sensible development working in cooperation, for example, with the Chinese. And the evidence is piling up that as the petrodollar system collapses, the criminal elite running the United States of America with their allies in Israel and Britain are prepared to do some pretty nasty things in order to keep the dollar at the top of the international food chain. But I'm afraid that's the bad news. The good news is they are incompetent and they will ultimately lose. That is my view.
Well, it's the International Business Times in India saying Ebola, is it a CIA-created demon? The conspiracy theory apparently is going viral as a meme shows the disease is created by white people. Now, this is pretty an interesting angle on it all, but it does seem to be, you know, mainly killing people of black ethnic origin.
Well, that's because of where it is. Don't forget, it's more to do with the geographical regions where it's happening. Africa is being destabilised through the creation of terrorist groups from Libya, which then helped Boko Haram and terrorist groups in Mali. Also, public health crises may be part of this destabilisation strategy. But it's quite clearly the case that all over the world, Western intelligence services are engaged in destabilisation of independent countries in order to achieve geopolitical goals.
Let me just carry on with the story, though. Conspiracy theory is saying that Ebola virus was created deliberately by Western countries using black magic and rituals, and it's going viral on Nigerian websites. This came after a meme on the disease spread amongst Nigerian citizens. The image or meme shows a white lady named Ebola Chan wearing a dress of a nurse holding a bloody skull. Her hair, long and dangling, is made to look like a dangerous Ebola virus strain. The meme got unbelievable traction amongst people scared. scared of the rampaging virus. Now, I mean, have people lost all sense over there? Taking something like this seriously? They're obviously very frightened.
They are, and don't forget there's a tradition of belief in this kind of thing in Africa anyway. This all helps to destabilise the countries concerned.
But just give us an idea of the possibility of where in the West, by a white person, something like this might have been actually made up.
No. The issue is that it's definitely the case that the US had a biological warfare facility in Sierra Leone, which may very well be the source of the virus. It certainly was Fort Detrick in Maryland, which is the source of the anthrax viruses, which were used on 9/11. And if they're capable of shooting down airplanes and all the other things that we're accusing them of, are they capable of spreading viruses in order to achieve their geopolitical goals? And I'm afraid the answer has to be yes. We can't be for sure that they did it, but the idea that they might is very definitely there. And we're running into a situation now where there is going to be a crash, as we said earlier in the first part of the show. And when that crash happens, it's not going to be the fault of the capitalist system. It's not going to be a fault of the politicians who've basically given a free run to these people. It's going to be the fault of foreign enemies, the Russians, the American, the Africans, the Chinese, ISIS. ISIS is, of course, being hyped into this huge threat on the basis of these so-called beheading videos, which are basically fake videos, as the Times has already pointed out. But the politicians are all mouthing off as if these videos had some kind of real valency, and they haven't.
What makes you say that? I mean, we've had three of these beheading videos now.
Yes, and various experts have said, in the mainstream media, I'm talking about Murdoch's Times, have looked at these videos and said they are fake. And don't forget the source for
all
these...
Well, they did the first one. I'm not sure about the second.
Do you know the source of all of these videos, Tony? It's a site called Search for International Terrorist Entities, which is based in Washington, D.C., and run by somebody with very close links to Mossad called Rita Katz. And they say that they got hold of these videos. ISIS were going to put these videos up and tell everybody how nasty they were, but because they're so clever people, Search for International Terrorist Entities, they got hold of the videos from ISIS before ISIS used them, and they used them. And that is the source of all three videos. Search for International Terrorist Entities from Washington, D.C., run by an ex-Mossad agent called Rita Katz. And that's where all these videos came from.
So are you saying that these beheadings didn't happen?
I'm saying that the beheadings didn't happen in those videos. They certainly didn't. Dr. David Halpin, who's one of the critics of the David Kelly inquest, he's been online saying, well, look, I'm a doctor. These people are not being beheaded. If you behead somebody... There are beheading videos on all over the internet. A score or more of people were beheaded in Saudi Arabia in August alone. And ISIS definitely does behead people. We've seen them beheading Syrian soldiers and civilians inside Syria. That's when they were the heroes of this time last year. They were the freedom fighters that we were going to bomb Assad to get rid of, to help to power. And they certainly do behead people. The fact is that these three videos are in fact fakes. They are not beheading videos at all, as the Times pointed out, and various experts have had a look at them. But nevertheless, the mainstream politicians in the West are pretending that these videos are real, just as they're pretending that the Russians shot down MH17, even though the evidence is overwhelmingly the opposite. And I'm afraid we've now reached a level of lies in the international media, which is definitely indicative that we're on the road to world war, I'm afraid.
You could possibly be right. ISIS in Iraq. France launches its first airstrike on the Islamic State targets. We just heard today in The Independent, Heather Saw writing, says France has carried out its first airstrike in Iraq, destroying a logistics depot held by the Islamic State. ISIS militants, the office of the President, Francois Hollande, said Rafael fighter jets struck the depot in northeast Iraq. The target was entirely destroyed.
What they want to do is ISIS has definitely been, in my view, been set up by Western intelligence services working with the Israelis. The al-Baghdadi, it transpires, is actually been trained.
ISIS leader, yeah?
Yeah, he's the caliph. He's supposedly the descendant of the prophet, according to the ideology that's being promulgated in the Western media. But Edward Snowden has pointed out, and it's floating around out there in the ether, that he's known to be a Mossad agent, and that in actual fact the whole of ISIS has been set up by Mossad and Western intelligence services. Because what they will then do is invade the area, And that means that they are then in control of the oil fields and they get their chance to remove Assad.
Well, it's
from
interesting
Damascus.
You say that, because we've also heard this week that Syrian rebels are in charge of the Golan Heights. Now, tell us about the historical and geopolitical significance of the Golan Heights.
Well, the Golan Heights were taken from Syria in the 1973 war by the
Israeli
army.
So it's officially part of Syrian territory?
It's officially Syrian territory, according to the international law, but it's been under the control of the Israelis since 1973. And there's been UN peacekeepers keeping the Israelis and the Syrian army separate. But now the Syrian army have been driven out of the region by al-Nusra Front and various other Islamic terrorists who are allied with al-Qaeda and with us, of course. Now the UN have been driven out, which allows the Israelis, if they wanted to invade Syria as part of a Western attack, not on ISIS, but ultimately to try and remove the regime in Damascus, which in fact Bashar al-Assad this year has won a presidential election in Damascus, which looks a lot more freer and fairer than the one we saw in Egypt. But nevertheless, he must go. This is what the strategy is. We were going to go to war with him this time last year because he supposedly used chemical weapons, although all the evidence suggests the opposite, that it was the rebels who used chemical weapons and that they probably got them from Libya through the hands, no doubt, of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who worked very closely with MI6. So I'm quite sure MI6 know an awful lot more about this than we imagine. That Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is on the record in France as saying before the Syrian war he was approached by British officials who said, "We are going to run an armed rebellion in Syria, do you want to participate?" So in other words, it's quite possible that David Cameron and MI6 are responsible for the war in Syria, with all of the deaths and destruction that that implies. Now, what should we do if we could prove that elements within MI6 were responsible for that war? What sort of punishment would you suggest would be appropriate for people like that, Tony?
Islamic State is a slur on our faith, say leading Muslims. This is in The Guardian, Saturday, 13th of December. Imams have called on David Cameron and others to stop using the phrase, which they say gives credibility to a terrorist organisation. The Prime Minister and media must stop legitimising the terror group rampaging through Syria and Iraq by describing it as Islamic State. According to a coalition of imams and organisations representing British Muslims, use of the jihadis' preferred title, they argue, gives credibility to the Sunni militants and slurs the Islamic faith. Signatories to a letter to David Cameron include Sugra Ahmed, President of the Islamic Society of Britain, and admits that UK Muslims need to do more to dissuade their young men from being misled into taking part in the group's hatred and poison. We shall take every opportunity to continue to say clearly and loudly, not in our name and not for our faith, they write.
Well, that's all very well, but in actual fact, I think there is overwhelming evidence that British special forces have been training these people. Now, somebody knows what's going on.
Now, I noticed one...
Somebody knows what's going on. Well, and we're going to find out.
Well, maybe we are, but maybe we're not. But one of the things that I did find online last week, which was really, I found quite fascinating and did seem to be, you know, some pretty damn good evidence, was a US Army tattoo on the arm of one of these ISIS fighters. Yep. Who had a some kind of hood on, so you couldn't see the guy's face. Couldn't really even tell what colour his skin was, but he had a US Army tattoo on his arm.
Well, also, of course...
An ISIS fighter.
Yes, and of course, ISIS fighters have also been going into Israel for medical treatment as a result of the removal of the UN peacekeepers on the Golan Heights. We are preparing for... They wanted to have a war with Syria this time last year, hence the whole chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, which seems to have been used with Libyan sarin, which came from the Libyan stockpiles, which was smuggled from Benghazi with the full knowledge of CIA and MI6. They killed however many people in Ghouta, but the evidence is overwhelming that was carried out by the rebels, supported by the Turks and the Saudis. And the Turks and the Saudis are our allies, not Assad's allies. Now, having failed to get a war on that basis, we're now going to go to war in Syria to fight Assad's enemies. Assad has been fighting ISIS tooth and nail for 3 and 4 years, and he's just won an election in Syria, which some say is not democratic, but it had a very high participation rate. People in Lebanon, for example, voted overwhelmingly for Assad, it seems, of the refugees. We are basically being pushed to war by a cabal of bankers, military-industrial complex and extreme Israeli nationalists.
The Washington Post is also saying the Senate, we've just heard today, the Senate has voted to approve Obama's plan to fight Islamist militants. President Obama's plan to train and equip moderate Syrian rebels exposed a deep rift Thursday among Democrats over waging war, with a large bloc of liberals staunchly opposed to the modest mission, fearing another long-term engagement in Iraq. While the Senate sent the measure Thursday to the White House for Obama's signature, votes this week demonstrated the tenuous support he has from his own party in carrying out the mission to degrade and destroy Islamic State's forces. Several of the party's rising stars, including Senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, rejected the proposal. While in the House, Obama's proposal won approval only because of a vast majority of Republicans backing him. Now, I don't know if you saw the speech by Obama, where was that, three or four days ago? It was an interesting speech. It was carried live on BBC World. That was Wednesday this week. And I looked at the speech. I thought, is this really as unscripted as it seems? Because Obama kept poking his ear as if he had a kind of earpiece in that wasn't working very well. But the idea was to create the illusion of the president giving this kind of off-the-cuff, heat-of-the-moment kind of speech without script. But maybe he's got somebody sort of whispering in his ear what he should say, and then he just repeats it.
Well, Obama is being made a prisoner to the right wing of US politics. I mean, don't forget they control the Senate and the Congress. And
so he's the president, but then his policies are being voted for by the Republican bloc, even though he's a Democrat. Well, in the Senate.
Well, the other bizarre thing is that they've also voted to supply the moderate rebels, so-called moderate rebels, with weaponry in order to fight ISIS. But the moderate rebels have just signed a deal not to fight ISIS. And in any case, there's no real difference between them. These people, many of them, have been trained by US and British special forces. And if there are any British special forces listening to us on this radio show and you know what's happening, perhaps you'd like to tell us and get your conscience clear.
Okay.
Because ultimately, if you don't, we are going to find out. We are, you know.
Well,
we are going to find out. There are warmongers at the heart of MI6 in this country. They may think that they're okay. They may think that they're safe. They may think that they control the media and that they will always get away with it. But I have a message for them. You will not.
I'm not Obama and I haven't got his audio, but I'll just tell you what one of the things he did say on Wednesday. He said, only 1% of Americans wear the uniform, but 100% must support our mission against ISIS.
This ISIS, as I've stressed before, has been created by Western intelligence services. According to the former French foreign minister, the British were particularly involved in all of this. Now we're going to kill lots of innocent people to defeat ISIS. But incidentally, we will also, as we go, try and overturn the government of Damascus in Damascus.
But Obama's saying is that America is the greatest force for freedom the world has ever known.
Well, that's just rhetoric, isn't it? Rhetoric. When you're shooting down airliners, carrying out terrorist attacks, we're going to move on to 9/11 in a minute. In actual fact, the US government is a threat to its own citizens and a threat to humanity on a scale bigger than Nazi Germany. And in the next few months, we are really going to get down and go to war probably over all of this. But those who have started this war should remember that you can start it, but the ordinary people of the world will finish it, and you will lose.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Oh, you're quite right, Martin. 9/11 is the subject up next, the 13th anniversary. I know that you were involved in London, weren't you, in I won't call it a commemoration. I don't know what you can call it, really. So just tell us what happened there.
Well, I'm one of the founder members of Reinvestigate 9/11 UK, and we just had a meeting, or a conference, as it were, in London on Tuesday.
And what were the subject matter? What were you looking
well,
at?
Well, there was various experts there putting their opinions. Probably the most important one from the point of view of the listeners would be Niels Harrit, Dr. Niels Harrit of Copenhagen University, who was one of the scientists that discovered nanothermite in the dust of the World Trade Center.
Okay, well, this sounds a little bit technical, and probably, it's a bit too sort of difficult to go into exactly. What is this nanothermite? Tell us about it.
Well, the point is that it's a very, very high-grade military explosive only in the hands of major governments like the US. And if nanothermite was in the dust from the World Trade Center, it means that the buildings were blown up with high-level explosives. And this has all been reviewed in the chemistry and physics journals. And Niels Harrit, as a senior professor at Copenhagen University, has played a major role in uncovering this. And of course, he, like many other experts, are convinced that the whole thing was an inside job.
Well, nanothermite, or superthermite, is a metastable intermolecular composite characterised by a particle size of its main constituents, metal and metal oxide, under 100 nanometers. So it's called nano because it's absolutely tiny, minuscule. This allows for high and customizable reaction rates. So the idea is this is a kind of explosive which is almost like a designer explosive.
Well, you can paint it on with a little paintbrush, but it still blows, it still destroys buildings because it's so powerful. And of course, something like that, as architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth in the US have pointed out, something like that must have been used because there isn't enough energy in aeroplane jet fuel fires to reduce not two but three buildings, one of which wasn't hit by a plane, WTC-7, not just to rubble but to dust.
Well, I would also point out that the transcripts and the actual recordings of the firefighters, the poor firefighters in that building, yeah, were actually saying, well, the fire's just about out now, just before the whole thing collapsed.
Well, no steel framed building in the world of that type has ever collapsed as a result of fire, and then on one day three different ones do. People should also just put WTC-7 into your search engine and watch the third building come down in 7 seconds, even though no plane hit it. I think the Russian General Staff, General Ivashov, the Chinese intelligence services, all serious journalists around the world are very well aware that 9/11 was some kind of inside job.
Martin,
we're going to have a world war.
Well, Martin, what about the Western intelligence services? What about the people like MI6, MI5? Don't you think that they would know whether this was some kind of an inside job or whatever?
Well, yes, but they're also implicated, I'm afraid, and that's part of the problem,
but
isn't
surely
it?
Surely it's only a few individuals, possibly, in those organisations.
No, well, listen, as a police officer, if you like, and looking at this, we don't presume anything. It might be just rogue elements, or it might be a policy from the top. What we need to do is actually chase up individuals and, dare I say it, waterboard them a bit and find out what they know. For example, we know for a fact that the Gladio networks in Western Europe have been involved in murder of civilians over decades. At Bologna, at Dortmund Beer Hall massacre, the Brabant massacres in Belgium, there's been an investigation by the Italian police force, a book written by the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato. The finger points very clearly at NATO intelligence services, particularly CIA and MI6. And that means that we in this country have a particular responsibility for all of this. And what makes me really angry as an English patriot, not a Scots or an Irish or a Welsh patriot, as an English patriot, is that our people seem to be very deeply involved in this. Now, we may have to do deals with other countries about who gets punished or not, but our people should be punished to the full extent
of the
law.
OK, well, let's have for evidence then. In what way are our people involved?
Because the Gladio network is run from SHAPE in Brussels, and it's basically a hierarchy like the rest of NATO. Small countries like Greece tend to be, and Italy, for example, tend to be the victims of Gladio. But the perpetrators of Gladio are based in the US and their sidekicks in London. And that's for the evidence that the Italian police have uncovered over many years. The idea that the British are some kind of nice guys and that we sort of try and get the Americans to behave a bit more reasonably, it's all cover. In actual fact, the City of London and Wall Street and Tel Aviv, they are the real axis of evil.
Okay, Martin, we're going to hear now from a chap called Bill Cooper. You hear him sometimes at the beginning of the second hour of this show. William Cooper, and a broadcast now recorded from July 2001, 2 months before the 9/11 attacks. Really quite amazing. He was a former US naval intelligence officer, worked on some of the flagships of the US Navy, carrying messages between the admirals, the captains, and US Navy headquarters. And this was a broadcast that he did just literally 2 months before the September the 11th attacks. And we'll ask Martin to comment on it after we've heard it.
The largest intelligence apparatus in the world, with the biggest budget in the history of the world, has been looking for Osama bin Laden for years and years and years, and can't find him. Some doofus jerk-off reporter with a camera crew waltzes right into his hideout and interviews him. So why do all these fools believe this charade? That a CNN reporter and his little camera crew can do But all the money and all the assets and all the eavesdropping and all the intelligence and all the satellites and all the undercover operatives in the world can never do. It's because they're not trying, they don't want to. Osama bin Laden is their creation, and he is serving them well. I mean, is this some kind of incredible joke that people are so stupid they'll fall for this? And now we're being bombarded with messages that Osama bin Laden is planning to attack the United States of America and Israel. Let me tell you something. If he's an enemy of Israel and the Mossad can't find him, then this thing is the biggest joke that you ever heard of in your life. And I'm telling you, be prepared for a major attack. But it won't be Osama bin Laden. It will be those behind the New World Order who once again want to take the guns and the freedom away from the American people, because we're the only ones left in the world who can oppose the destruction of freedom in the world and the implementation of a one-world totalitarian government, and that is the goal. And whatever is going to happen that they're going to blame on Osama bin Laden, don't you even believe it. To change the minds and the attitudes and the beliefs of the people of the world, and especially the United States, to bring about one-world totalitarian government. I wonder what Osama bin Laden's targets are supposed to be. And if this doesn't materialize in the next 2 or 3 weeks, it will eventually materialize, because they haven't succeeded in getting the guns out of the hands of the American people, nor have they succeeded in taking our freedoms away. In fact, there's been a great awakening in this country and a big backlash against these Marxist, communist, puke-faced, lying, subversive, Nazi, jackbooted Gestapo thugs that is gaining momentum. And so I can tell you with a certainty, they must do something terrible in order to stop this backlash and regain the sympathy of the mass herds of sheeple out there. And supposedly, we're not the only nation searching for Osama bin Laden. So the vast economic resources, the vast technological resources, the vast personnel resources, the vast networks and intricate web spun over all these years by the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA can't find Osama bin Laden, but CNN can.
Well, I mean, obviously, my political views will be rather different from those of William Cooper. I mean, I'm not particularly in favour of guns and ownership of guns. I actually would identify myself as a Marxist, so I wouldn't identify with that. But I would point out that John O'Neill, the deputy director of the FBI, gave a press conference in July 2001 with Brissard and Daski, who are French journalists who worked for the French Secret Service, where he said, "I have resigned as deputy director of the FBI because the American government is protecting bin Laden. Every time I get close to arresting him, they tell me not to do it." And of course, John O'Neill then got a new job as director of security in the World Trade Center and died in the 9/11 attacks. And the other obvious point to make to people, apart from WTC-7, a third building collapsing with no plane hitting it, is where was the United States Air Force for an hour and a half on the morning of 9/11? If people think back to the Battle of Britain in 1940, as soon as enemy planes were detected by radar, there was a huge scramble operation went on. Three supposedly hijacked aircrafts fly all over the internal airspace of the US without any kind of intervention whatsoever from the United States Air Force, which must be the most expensive air force in history, protecting the most defended spot on the planet, the Pentagon. What happened to them all? Where were they? Well, we know where they were. They'd all been put on a stand down by Dick Cheney and others. Now, it's about time, 13 years later, as World War III is about to kick off, that people wake up to where we are. 9/11 was an inside job. We're not quite sure if it was carried out by the Israelis and their allies in the West, or just by allies in the West with the Israelis. It doesn't really matter. The Russian general staff know what I'm talking about. General Ivashov, who was in command of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, if people go and check his blog, you'll be absolutely clear where they stand. We are on the verge of disaster here, because people have basically allowed themselves to be lied and bamboozled down the road into this war.
But
But how come then, when CNN managed to get hold of Bin Laden, as William Cooper was talking about then, there weren't questions in the press saying, well, how come CNN can get hold of him, but all of the Western intelligence services don't know where he is?
Well, that's because the Western press and people in general are trusting. They presume that the people in charge in the West, because we have a semi-democratic setup, are basically doing the right things, but perhaps make mistakes.
Yeah, and people are also thinking, well, nobody wants a war, aren't they?
Well, of course, nobody. If you want war, if you want peace, prepare for war, and that's what the world movement for peace and justice must recognise. We have been pushed into a situation now where there is going to be a world war, and all I can say is thank God for the Russian armed forces, as in World War II. Let's hope by using the techniques of exposure and carefully calibrated response, that they will be able to bring this Nazi war machine, because that's what it is, to account before this war is over.
Well, William Cooper made that prediction in July 2001. September 2001, 2 months later, the 9/11 attacks happened, and 2 months after that, William Cooper was shot dead by the FBI.
Well, you don't surprise me. And that's the real world we're living in, folks. And it's going to get worse before it gets better, I'm afraid.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
Well, 70 years ago this week, the biggest airborne operation ever took place. It was towards the end of World War II, September 1944, and the liberation of Holland, Operation Market Garden. The failure of this operation, which was an attempt to get a bridgehead into the Ruhr, which would end the war by Christmas 1944, allowed Hitler an extra 6 months to bury his treasure, the looted wealth of all of Europe before the end of the war. So, was Market Garden sabotaged by Nazi spies and Brits who wanted a share of the loot? Well, one character that figures very heavily in the Operation Market Garden, the planning for it, and anyway, also the leaking of the plans to the Nazis, is a guy called Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. Now, he was born as a German prince. He married into the Dutch royal family before the war, and then he was brought over to the United Kingdom, obviously the Dutch royal family in exile. And at that point, there was a question about whether he could be trusted, because he was a former SS officer. He had been in the SS over in Germany. He'd been an enthusiastic member, one of the first people to join it when it was first set up. Martin, how is it that this guy was peering over the shoulders of Monty and Brian Horrocks, who was the commander of the land forces in the liberation of Holland, when they were planning it, a former Nazi officer?
Well, it may well be that he's the source of the information that the Germans got, which allowed them to have a panzer division in place which shouldn't have been there, and so forth. But don't forget that at the end of the Second World War, the ruling elites in Western Europe were preparing to do deals with selected Nazis, particularly Martin Bormann. And the OSS, the forerunner of the CIA, recruited, for example, Reinhard Gehlen, the former head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, and he ends up ultimately as the head of the West German Intelligence Services, the BND.
So there were
NATO from the get-go was bringing in former Nazi intelligence
operatives. And there were also all sorts of deals being done before the end of the war as to what the end game was going to be after the war.
That's right.
But let's go now to listen to Major Tony Hibbert. He was in the 1st Airborne Division, Brigade Major, and he was actually at the bridge at Arnhem in the famous film, you may well know, A Bridge Too Far. And here he is giving his take on why the operation didn't succeed.
Wireless reception, which came and went, and every now and again you got through to them, and I told them that Brigadier disappeared and that Johnny Frost would be commanding the brigade from now onwards, and that I would transmit his orders. About half an hour after that, at somewhere about 10 o'clock, I managed to get Brigadier Lathbury on the wireless radio, and I told him that we'd got about 600 men on the bridge and that we were holding the northern perimeter and that we had removed the charges on the bridge, but that we'd failed to get any troops south of the river, And I said that Lion Route, which was the southernmost route which we'd used, was still open. If you will send one battalion or one company from each battalion down Lion Route, there will be no opposition. I strongly recommend that you do one of these two things. And Brigadier Lasprey said, no, I've decided that we're in contact with the enemy and we're not really well organized at the moment, and my troops are too tired, and I will order them to stay where they are and make a determined attempt in first light, and I will come down Lion Route. And of course, that was the moment we lost the battle. If he had detached either one battalion or two companies to get onto the bridge, we'd have had enough troops on the bridge itself to hold out. On the bridge, we were overrun on about 10 o'clock on Wednesday night, the 20th, and at the same time, the Lord Carrington in his tanks had just got across Nijmegen Bridge. If we'd had probably that extra company or two companies on the north end of the bridge, we could have held out for those extra 2 or 3 hours which would have taken for our troops from the south to get up to us. I think it cost us the battle, because if he'd only sent us probably an extra two companies at that moment, that would have enabled us to widen the perimeter, which we were the very small perimeter that we were holding, and that would have enabled us to hang on probably for another 12 hours at least.
Well, that was one of the reasons that they didn't succeed, Martin. But also, when the tanks did turn up at the next bridge, the Nijmegen Bridge, which was about 11 miles down the road, we had an amazing event where the tanks decided to stop for 17 hours. So that even if the extra force that Tony Hibbert was talking about had made it to the Arnhem Bridge, it may not have actually managed to get to Arnhem in time, because this amazing 17-hour break. Anyway, I also interviewed a chap called T. Moffat Burris, who was one of the American paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne Division. They actually took the Nijmegen Bridge, and then he was gobsmacked to find that Lord Carrington, when he rolled across the bridge in his tanks, had decided to halt. So let's have a listen to Moffat Burris, who I spoke to a couple of years ago.
I was talking to Carrington. He was sitting in his tank, and we were having this argument about him not moving out, and when he failed to move, and I ordered him to, and he still failed to move, I cocked my Tommy gun and put it to his head and told him if he didn't get this blankety-blank tank moving, I'd blow his head off. And with that, he ducks down into the tank, closes the hatch, and sits there the rest of the night. Couldn't get to him. As I understand, Carrington denies that anybody pulled a gun on him, but his memory is not quite as good as mine if he really believes that. I bumped into Carrington at the 65th anniversary celebration at a reception that we're having for the Queen. And as he walked up, General Petraeus and I were talking, and he introduced me to Carrington, and I said, well, we know each other. We met on the bridge 65 years ago. And Carrington turned and looked at me, and he said, oh, you're the chap that called me a yellow-livered coward. And I said, is that what I called you? And he said, yes. And said, you didn't really expect me to follow the orders of a foreign government, did you? And I said, of course I did. And then it went on to some small talk from that point.
So, Martin, what was the significance of the failure at Arnhem then, historically?
Well, obviously you've done more research on this than I have, but ultimately deals were being done behind the scenes with elements within the Nazi regime and the Americans and the British. Not everybody was in on the deal. Moffat Burrows obviously wasn't. Carrington possibly was. Paul Manning's book is about how Bormann was extracted from Germany and sent to Argentina with the help of MI6.
Okay, and let's finish tonight with the testimony of a chap called Sir Brian Urquhart. He was the first Allied Airborne Armies, one of them's intelligence officers in the run-up to Market Garden, and he was one of the people who predicted that it was going to be a disaster, and he made himself very unpopular by saying so. So let's hear Sir Brian Urquhart and his ideas on the Market Garden campaign as thousands of people gather over in Holland today and over the next few days, and from yesterday actually, to commemorate the last anniversary, probably where the people who are still alive who were actually at the anniversary can be there. So we'll leave you tonight with Sir Brian Urquhart's thoughts on the Operation Market Garden.
I finally got sent away, I think, for a remark which turned out to be oddly prophetic, because our general, who was a very dashing figure called Boy Browning, said to Prince Bernard of the Netherlands that the Allied forces were going to advance into Germany over a carpet of airborne troops. And I said to our chief of staff, I wonder if they're going to be alive or dead airborne troops. This didn't go well at all. So everybody decided then that they'd had enough, and I got sent away. I asked if I could stay just as an ordinary officer in the operation. They said no. So you'll be court-martialed if you disobey orders. And everybody had enough trouble by that time, so I went. Well, the thing went very seriously wrong. And I then realized what I hadn't realized before, that these generals and great commanders and politicians who one so admired during the war were actually just like everybody else. They were vain, they were ambitious, they very often made extremely faulty judgments. I had not thought of that before. I had always thought they were kind of super people. And I must say that it remained with me for the rest of my life. I've never really trusted well-known sort of glamorous leaders to really resist vanity and ambition and make the right mature decision and get it right. Well, I left the airborne business rather naturally after Battle of Arnhem, because I was pretty unpopular. If you want to get really, it's very unpopular to be the one person who opposes something that everybody else wants to do. But if you turn out to be right, you get seriously unpopular. And I was seriously unpopular because I was right.
So Community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, Alex Salmond says he's standing down as Scotland's First Minister and SNP leader after the country voted to no to independence.
It has been the privilege of my life to serve as First Minister. But as I said often enough during this referendum campaign, this is a process which is not about me or the SNP or any political party. It's much, much more important than that.
Mr. Salmond will stay in the job until the party's conference in November. Tom Harrigan has been assessing the mood after the vote.
You don't have to look far to find disappointed Yes supporters.
I'm feeling really, really deeply, deeply, deeply depressed.
This would have been our only opportunity and we missed it.
The blue and white Yes badges have vanished from people's lapels. Stickers lie trodden into the wet ground. But there were still more than 1.5 million Yes voters, which gives optimism to some.
I'm certain that at some point, I don't know when, but I'm certain at some point we will become independent. It's absolutely the direction of our travel.
David Cameron is now promising more devolution to Scotland. No supporters want him to keep his word.
If he follows through with it, I'd be very happy. I think it's what's been wanted for a long time.
But another vote like this is probably now a generation away.
Meanwhile, several hundred pro-union supporters have gathered in Glasgow's George Square. The